a forum that is dealing on the topic of fear and the fear of the bear in the global village. What we fear about the Soviet Union and what it is that holds us back from decreasing armaments in the life of this country. With that, I know a number of people who have strong feelings, and I would like you to begin to share. We'll just start at that point to talk about some of your fears about the Soviet Union and power politics. Do you have a fear, Larry, or were you going to respond to something earlier?
I'm responding to the film. I don't know if it's really fits you.
Okay. What I'll come back to later. It'll probably come in. I know that there are a couple persons that I've talked to earlier. Sir, in the back, what is your name? I didn't get that earlier. Yeah. We talked afterwards. And
Steve.
If you could share the concern that you raised with the film, Ground Zero Banger.
Okay. In the film, all of the aims were toward disarmament from, believe it or not, all of the people who were being interviewed one way or the other. I can't say interviewed is probably wrong, but all those who spoke in the film, whether they were retired admirals from the military industrial complex, politicians, or what have you. And the concern that I raised was that in the film, as to the intense, the political base, the theology of those who are on the other side of the question of nuclear power in terms of an armament or defense or offense mechanism. Very clearly, when I said that, I meant in terms of the communist power.
Do you feel that there is any hope for that, or do you feel that that is a lost cause to even consider that kind of dialogue?
I just raised it as an issue that wasn't spoken to in the film.
Well, I'll be your straight man and get things going here. For a number of years, I've been writing my congressman and talking with people about urging a stronger military position for the United States. And I come at that from a historical perspective. I'm a historian by education, and I've read a great deal. And it strikes me that Americans are, by virtue of our history, unable to comprehend the mental set of the people who rule the Soviet Union. And that mental set isn't necessarily just a communist mental set. To some extent, it's almost a uniquely Russian mental set. And I want to go back a little bit and then come forward. We had a couple of revolutions against the American Revolutionary Government, the Whiskey Rebellion, and there was a conspiracy to split off the Mississippi Basin at one point. And the people who were involved in those rebellions in this country, given the kind of basically enlightened, liberal perspective that we came from, really weren't dealt with terribly harshly. I mean, when George Washington marched against the rebelling farmers in Pennsylvania and Ohio and whatnot that wouldn't pay taxes to the federal government, he didn't string up a lot of people. He didn't, you know, burn villages and massacre people, but he simply imposed the law and reimposed order. About the same time in the Soviet Union, we have what we call an enlightened czar, Romanov, by the name of Peter the Great, who had a rebellion against him. And he burned alive 10,000 men to impress upon his subjects that he wouldn't tolerate that kind of behavior. he didn't burn them alive, he roasted them alive. He built enormous fires and he roasted them slowly. Now, this is essentially the same century that I'm talking about, and two different ways of dealing with political problems. We come forward with that tradition, and our tradition is one of reconciling problems through orderly processes of rational discourse, of argumentation, of winning over people through the weight of our ideas. The Russian approach is a much different approach. It's a different kind of historical development. If you read Solzhenitsyn, it's almost incomprehensible to us the numbers of the millions of people who were slaughtered in the 30s in Russia for belonging to subversive organizations like the Boy Scouts. You know, these people were considered a threat because they were part of organizational structures that were not controlled by the Soviet regime, so they were killed. Now, it's hard for us to we can't comprehend that. We don't have any historical base to comprehend the mass slaughter of people because their thinking is a little bit different than, you know, the norm of those people in power. And I'm not talking about, you know, saying I'm just saying that we come at history from different mental sets and problem solving from different mental sets. The Soviet Union is an imperialistic power which has not yet matured. In our lifetimes, it is one of the only countries in the world that I can think of which has continued to expand and expand rapidly, taking land from, you know, in this century and the last few decades. From Japan, from Finland, from Poland, from Germany, not to mention the Baltic Republics, now Afghanistan, and who knows what next, Iran within 5 years. It's an expanding power. We don't know how to cope with this. And I think that it's deluding ourselves to think that if we simply proceed along the way that we solve problems, which is rational discourse, and sitting down and just working things out in a rational way, and realizing that we're all people together on this small planet, and if we just kind of get together and love one another, that everything's going to work out okay. I don't think it is, because I don't think that's the way they come about their history. And I think the only way that we can preserve liberal, humanitarian, culture as we know it is by being willing to defend it, not to attack anybody, but just by saying, we're going to fight for this. We think that there's something here worthy of saving. And if you kick me in the knee, I'm going to kick you back. That's the only thing that it seems that will preserve us, will save us, in my mind. So I'm your straight man.
Thank you. Responses.
I agree.
Okay.
Well, to me, trying to quantify how much Russia has or what kinds of missiles they have, what kinds of missiles we have, is to me, I'm trying to at that point decide what the odds are of my being killed. The way, how strong I am, how the guy is, and how many hits will he get, how many hits will I get, who gets the last hit, who's alive, and it's all done. That's what it boils down to. And at that point, I'm telling myself, basically, if the odds look bad after I've waited out, am I going to follow through with my Christian conscience at that point? The odds look good, and it's easy to say, well, let's reduce arms, and maybe I would do that. I feel really frustrated because I'm not ready to say, let's build up and give me a strong armed it, and then give me a new. And I'm not ready to say, God rules the world, and I'm not going to fight. Kill me. I'm not ready to do either. and I'm not ready to embrace either side, and I feel like I can't do anything with that. I'm stuck. And for me, to say that the American government approaches things in a logical frame of mind is very naive. I look back to one time we had a revolution and overthrew a nation, several nations that were here before we were, and slaughtered them. I think around several slow fire probably. I think people are pretty similar. Just depends on where they find themselves as to how they react. And to me, I really feel frustrated to approach the subject from the standpoint of who has the biggest muscle. I feel like we're just really not looking at what Christ was offering. But I don't have an answer.
Thank you. Other sharings. Primarily fears that we have. Any other persons who have a fear of the Soviet Union and why?
I think my greatest fear in thinking about total disarmament, which is what I would feel would be an ideal thing if it would work, my greatest fear is not being killed off or, you know, having bombs set over here and being blown up. My greatest fear, I guess, is you know, being a slave to someone else and not being able to live my faith or not being able to have our children live their faith and people around us and losing freedom. And so when I think in terms of disarmament, I was trying to bring it down to an individual level. What would I do if someone attacked me? And at some point, if I thought I could get out of it, I would do that first. And I think at some point I would defend myself, and even more so, I would defend someone else if they were being attacked. And so I put it down on a personal level instead of a nation level. That's where I'm coming from. But I already feel losing freedoms and not being able to worship. And so when I go to print, there's so many things in that.
Thank you.
Ask for fears. The fear I have of the Soviet Union is that it is economically a very weak system. Agricultural base of the country is very weak. Any country that is agriculturally weak is generally insecure. And when the system really starts to crack and really starts to break apart, the only thing they're going to have left are their weapons. And they're going to have nothing to lose. In other words, it's nothing that we have anything to do with. It's an internal system that right now they have, you know, like a weak child with a big gun. Economically, we have nothing to fear from that country. Agriculturally, politically. The problem is they've got a very large weapon. And when they internally start to crumble, and that system really, and of course that's what they fear about Poland. Poland is a worse fear to them than anything they've got going. But when they internally start to crumble, which they're pretty close to anyway, economically, I don't know what they're going to do. You know, how rational are they going to be? I mean, that system is decrepit.
Well, the Russians are what? They're going to be less than 50% of the Soviet Union now. Because they are. I said the Russians are going to be what? Less than 50% of the Soviet Union? They are an empire. And the diversity of that empire, religiously, ethnically, and so forth, is very diverse. And that I understand that there are parts of their armed forces, and our own figures don't come across with this, but they don't even give them guns. They don't know what side they fight on. I mean, so they are this. So when you see all these numbers of all these Soviet troops, that's not exactly something that the Soviet Union really is that much secure about. So that's a real worry, I think, that I have, is that exactly like you say, that system, it fits in with what you said. The system will start to crumble, and then they'll strike out desperately to go ahead and do something about it for internal reasons. And it, what we have may have nothing to do with it. And that's a fear.
I have a fear. I'd like to respond to what the woman said over here about defending our freedom, and particularly defending our freedom of worship. I get really afraid when we start talking about particularly defending our freedom to worship, because I feel like if we have to defend the freedom to worship as Christians with that kind of military might, that we run the risk of destroying the very thing that we wish to preserve.
A good example for me of that is no matter how much persecution or pressure that's been put on in China in the last 25 or 30 years, the Christian church has grown in China in the last 25 or 30 years. And they didn't do that with weapons. The thing is, there are many ways we could lose freedom and still have a freedom to worship. I mean, people in Poland can worship. There are Christians in Russia that can worship.
Other comments?
I have fears about the Soviet Union. I think I fear even more our response. I think there's a kind of self-fulfilling cycle that is set in motion, where the fear and hysteria in one camp plays upon the fertile ground of the same in the other camp. And I've come to appreciate a lot of perspectives from Europe and from the Third World that worry about the U.S. and the USSR and the fear that is set in motion in both camps. I mean, Ronald Reagan said in the campaign, he told the Wall Street Journal, "Let us not delude ourselves. The Soviet Union underlies all the unrest that is going on. If they weren't engaged in this game of dominoes, there wouldn't be any hot spots in the world." I think that's an incredibly erroneous picture of the way history works. I mean, Iran and Iraq would be at war with one another. I don't know how in the world the Soviet Union got into Northern Ireland. That conflict is behind that. There would still be civil war in El Salvador. The Israelis and the Palestinians would be at loggerheads with one another. But that still shapes our response. I mean, 1954, John Foster Dulles and President Eisenhower decided that they had to stop the expansionism of the Soviet Union, and did it by overthrowing government in Guatemala. Now we're at the edge of civil war in Guatemala, and we're reading Central America in terms of the Soviet threat. This plays upon that kind of fear and that kind of reading of history from both sides has the effect of this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. And we increase our armaments, and then they increase their armaments. We look for some way or another to get back to the SALT talks, but we can't manage a minimal level of trust to manage that, because we're sure of the actions of the other. It ends up being a conspiratorial mindset on both sides, and the consequences are not only consequences destructive of the USSR economy. I don't see how in the world we're going to raise the defense budget $1 trillion in the next few years without subverting our own and without causing inflation to climb. I mean, it's just a madness And that's genuine fear on my part of the Soviet Union, but it's also a genuine fear of our response to that and what it sets in motion.
Marty, I have something I'd like to tag on to the end of that lyric. Not only do I think that spending $1 trillion on American defense will have an incredible effect on our inflationary situation as it stands today, though maybe Paul Hayne would disagree. I'm not so sure he would, because we talked about that. But let's look at it from the side of the Soviet Union. If we enter into another, quote, arms race, into what everybody seems to call an escalation or a restocking of our stockpiles, or maybe catching up, if we look at history again, whenever one side has taken a step, the other side has interpreted that as having to take a step as well. Well, if the Soviet Union tries to spend an equivalent amount of money on defense, and if their economic situation is as bad as this gentleman down here describes, and which I think economic figures will verify, I think you'll see a far worse economic condition in the Soviet Union because of our escalation, of our expenditure of money on new arms. And all that will serve to do is bring about this intense anxiety within the Soviet structure. And my, as far as I can tell, I can't see how it would do anything but hasten conflict. Simply because the anxiety would be raised, because the economic situation within the Soviet Union could do nothing but decrease. That's a lot of money to spend on something that isn't very productive.
There's got to be some place, though, between MX systems, which I'll tell you that I wrote letters against also while I was calling for a better defense. I thought the MX system is stupid. There's got to be some place between MX systems and the fact that our normal defense establishment is essentially non-functional. I mean, the Polish army could roll over the Western Europe tomorrow and probably take it out. I don't know if you saw this CBS News thing on the army, the American army in Germany recently. Our tank drivers can't read the instructions on how to propel the tanks that they've got. I mean, there's got to be some level between competent, reasonable defense and spending trillions for toys that probably wouldn't work anyway, and God help us if we ever wanted to use them. There's got to be some reasonable level between simply being able to hold off the Soviet Union if it does start to crumble, and if they do say, you know, if the Brezhnevs do say in their dying years, let's knock out the West as our last act to make sure that we preserve and maintain this system. You know, if that becomes the last act that they want to have in their particular play, then we need to be in a position to say no, we don't want to have that act. And it's going to be too costly for you. Preserve socialism some other way without taking out the West. But, you know, is there a feeling here that there's something between all-out trillion-dollar arms build-ups and some reasonable, workable, viable defense? Because that's all I want. I just want to know that if there's a soldier out there and he's got a rifle, that he knows how to shoot it, or if he's driving a tank, he knows how to drive it, and if there's an artillery piece that takes four men to operate, that they can read and write, read the instruction books, they know what they're supposed to do, and not the joke that we've got now. Is there some middle ground, I guess?
A response here, and then I'll go over to Rudy. Okay. Did you want to respond? Okay. Rudy?
I just wanted to call our attention to the fact that we are not very well informed on the Soviet economy and the Soviet potential in terms of resources. It's been a struggle of our country for a long time to keep properly controlled. We know that the Siberian area has tremendous potential. And there is no reasonable doubt about that. They have much oil, much coal, much iron, and many of the metals that we are now short of. And so from just a natural resource potential to create trouble in the world, they have a great deal of potential. And even the CIA now is beginning to soft pedal many of the things that they have put out, that Russia soon would be importing oil and various things. Now that picture is changing as we begin to get better surveillance of the Soviet territory as a result mainly of our space activity. And we're now being able to do some monitoring that we never have had the capacity to do before. And that is, to me, a very real potential and a real source of fear. Because if they choose and do develop this, which obviously is going to be difficult to develop because of the nature of the country itself, it's bleak, people don't like to work in it. But if they're more or less forced to, for economic reasons, they may do it. And if they choose to use their power, then, that they can generate, they have a different approach to their economy than we have to ours. Things are done for political reasons, strategic reasons, and military reasons, and not for the kinds of reasons that we try to emphasize in our own economy. And they will go to another country, they will provide the metals, the material, the oil, whatever, and they don't worry about the price of it. And where we develop it and send it to the same country, in our economy, we need to have some dollars back. In other words, the private enterprise is based on a very different system than simply centralized government control.
Thank you.
The challenge always in the forums is to try and at some point bring the question back to our particular context, which is not just Americans gathered around the fire, but people who confess that Jesus is Lord. And I guess my fear is that we're misplacing our fear, that the Soviet Union is not really the boogeyman in all this, but that they are a kind of tool or a kind of representative of something which we fear in ourselves, which is this radical notion that Jesus accepted the task of being a servant. That for Jesus, the way to usher in the kingdom of God, the way to realize what God had in mind for this earth, was precisely in taking the form of a servant. So if our fear is of the Russians, I think that's a little misplaced, because what we really fear is being subservient to Russians. And I wonder whether that doesn't come into kind of direct conflict with what Jesus had in mind when he took the form of a servant and said that was the way the kingdom would come. It undoubtedly means that many servants die. There's no question about that. And Jesus led the way. But there seems to me there must be some truth in the notion that if you wanted to enter the heart of a Russian, it would be through being his or her servant and showing them the same kind of love we feel in understanding that Christ died as our servant.
Just to tag on to Martin, I think that sometimes we've made an idol of the freedom of worship, and if that's become more important than being faithful, and the call of faithfulness is a call to serve the Lord. It's not a call to defend the freedom of worship, but it's a call to be faithful to what, to how we understand God's love is active in the world.
When a conquering nation takes over your country, and they don't have a particularly good reputation for being nice guys when they take over a country, I don't think it's going to be a matter of, you know, hey, we want to be your servant. I fear things like the Holocaust, were the Jews really given the opportunity to be the servants of the Germans? No, not really. My Russian teacher, she was in East Germany, and she said she really feared that they were going to be freed by the Russian army, and that was a very real fear to her, because they didn't have a very good reputation. How are you?
Some gut level kinds of fears. I guess in the past few years, I've had to start thinking about where, you know, who is going to fight that war. As Christians, where do we stand in support of killing and loyalty to country? And I guess I've had to face that because I have two boys that one of them has now had to register for the draft. And one of the fears is that we would have another war that would be a Vietnam-style war, where it would be just a war of ineptness, and that my children would be killed, be a part of that. And I hear my oldest son being very, patriotic, saying, boy, I'd be right out there in the front lines, Mom. And that makes my gut turn over, because I know that war is not, to me, good. It's very evil, and all kinds of bureaucratic garbage goes on, and people are killed for no reason. And I guess I really am repulsed by that, and I don't know where the church stands in that. Or as Christians, I know different churches have come out in stands of, you know, anti-draft counseling for kids. And I guess I feel a lot of ambivalence on my part of being loyal to my country and yet not being for killing. And people maybe who know more than I do about this whole area maybe could give me some input on that.
I have similar fears on that. My two sons. And I guess I fear that the real fear I have is not so much the Soviet Union. I do have some fears on the Soviet Union. I'm not naive about that. You know, we're just nice to them, they'll be nice to us, and it could raise some important issues. But my fear is that it's more internally. We're going to get wrapped up in kind of a more militaristic way of thinking, and we'll be using the words defending freedom, but really we'll be looking for resources and oil and things like that. And that just is horrible to see the kind of waste of resources we have, and the idea that as I practice really trying to cut back on resources, that my sons would be drafted to go out and steal them from somebody else. I mean, you talk about something as being totally un-Christian, and yet in our nation, even that wouldn't count as conscientious objection unless you can stand up and say, under all circumstances, I'm a pacifist. And I don't know whether I can after hearing the Holocaust and hearing what happened there. I mean, I don't think I could just sit by in the Holocaust situation and be a complete pacifist. And yet, legally, I guess that's what you have to be if you want to, you know, you can't just say, I won't fight for this because I don't believe in stealing resources from someone else because we wasted them. You're not allowed to say that. And that bothers me. That really does.
Along with David's remark and back to Marty's, I guess I fear the fact that the action of two great superpowers in a world in which both of them are losing power. I think it's demonstrable that the Soviet Union has lost great power in the last two decades actually. With China, with Yugoslavia, with being kicked out of Egypt, African countries don't want them around. Even the countries that asked for arms, like we did when we asked the French in the Revolutionary War, but had no notion whatsoever of being subservient to a European monarchy. Even African countries who have done much the same thing just don't want them. I mean, Zimbabwe is highly stringent terms on dealing with the Russians. The United States has had somehow or another to face the fact that it's a multipolar world and not a bipolar world, and Vietnam was one kind of watershed on that. And here you've got two superpowers facing a complex world in which power is shared more widely and can be subverted more easily. And it reminds me it's like we're trying to hold on to power and control because we have such an enormous amount at stake internally. So that the first press conference, or one of the first ones with the president, he mentioned for the first time that I can recall the fact that sub-Sahara Africa has minerals vital to our national defense and to our economy, and therefore it was necessary to try and work out some different relations with South Africa than had been the case with the Carter administration. What happens when two superhuman superpowers both sense a loss of power and control? That generates for me genuine fears. And I guess, getting to Marty's point, I would come at it a little bit differently. I would think one call for the Christian community that we ought to heed is a call to somehow handle loss of power, loss of control, that the world is not one simply to be of our own fashioning and of our own making, that is to be shared, and that psychologically our security and even deep down our freedom is not synonymous with our control. I think there is all over the Old and New Testament pictures of a sense of security and control and of power that just are so at odds with the way in which we seem to think that the world will be unlivable if we cannot be in a position to hold the levers. And the Soviet Union, I suspect, feels much the same way.
I comment, getting back to the original introductory statements regarding the mindset of the Soviet Union and looking at the mindset of we as a people and where we come from, and perhaps looking at the United States from the Soviet perspective, they would have to look at us as an extremely aggressive and a very violent people in terms of what we have done in the last, 100 years, 150 years, manifest destiny. And, you know, is manifest destiny something in the past? Is it something we continue to espouse in terms of wading in every time an opportunity arises, whether it be Korea or Vietnam or Guatemala or any number of different places that we have chosen to impose our will, as the case may be? And you look at a situation like Vietnam, and Vietnam is, for the American people in general, try to express it that way, is regrettable only in the fact that, we lost. If we hadn't lost, it would have been another heroic triumph over the forces of evil. And Christianity is kind of involved in that also, in that because the third world countries happen to be different or whatever, whether they be Buddhist or whatever, I think that the manifest destiny idea kind of has its roots in, the Christian ideas and, the Christian philosophy of expanding and sharing, by whatever means necessary, Christianity with the third world. And you bring that down to our situation today, and for example, we very much fear the loss of Western Europe and their cooperation with the Soviet Union. An example is the Reagan's administration's very adamant opposition to a natural gas pipeline linking Western Europe with the Soviet Union, and we want them in our camp and to expand their military might and increase their forces and buy our technological weapons, that kind of thing, rather than to cooperate with the Soviet Union, which is what they want to do. What they want to do is develop some economic ties with the Soviet Union, and we're saying, hold back, don't do that. Don't cooperate with the Soviet Union, don't get involved, but hang back with us because we're the tough guys and, we're going to stand up to those bad guys over there. And yet, from the Soviet perspective, they're looking at us as being the aggressor and, the big bear, so much as you might say, from the West, as we're pointing the finger and saying the same with them. And the frightening thing about it is American leadership and their perspective that we see up towards the Soviet Union, and here we have these two superpowers looking at each other from the same paranoia, you might say, for example. And it's really kind of frightening. I don't have all that much faith in American leadership and looking across the ocean at the other side.
Thank you.
I want to express my fear, and this might sound corny, but I'll say it anyway. I think I'm afraid of God, because I think God is going to zap the U.S. and God is going to zap Russia. And it's going to raise up some weak people of this earth to see if they can do a little better job. And question, will I be ready to celebrate that when it comes? Will we be singing the Lord's song? Again, I looked around in Vespers and I didn't see one person not singing, "He Rules the World." And all were singing that. And I wondered, do we believe that? Are we mouthing words? Is the outcome of this world up to us? Or do we believe he's got the world in his hands? And I'm afraid always to say this because I guess I'm a little paranoid myself that maybe 3/4 of the people are saying, now we'll get through with this naivety and get back to the discussion. But I'll
four
say
fifths.
But four fifths. I hardly ever speak at forums because I don't like to. But I always, if I can be an irritant, to remind who rules the world, I will. I want to say that. And that's what I'm afraid of God, because it's going to zap us. Okay. Thank you.
Marilyn, did you?
In the film Ground Zero at Vanguard, the admiral says that he thinks that unilateral disarmament would be silly. And to relate that to how we look at the Soviet Union and how we feel we must rationally or logically respond, I guess I agree with his comment. That to unilaterally disarm would be silly, and that to not operate out of very rational kinds of fears would be silly and foolish. That these are all very real weapons that are stockpiled. There's very real struggles for power between the Soviet Union and the leadership the leadership of the Soviets and the leadership of the United States. That is very real and tangible. I would not deny that any of that is reality. The powerful nation or empire which he faced and which opposed his kind of kingdom, his kind of politics, I think we're faced with very similar things in our day and age. And I think we're going to have to be asking ourselves in the next few years if, like Dan said, we really do believe that Jesus is Lord. Because to me, it comes down to a question of idolatry. It comes down to a question of, do I really think that Christ is normative for my whole life? Am I really going to follow the foolishness of his kingdom and really believe that he will usher in shalom someday?
I would like to answer a couple of the fears that seem to be not fears. Someone alluded to Central America, and I don't know whether they did or did not fear missiles in Cuba, which fortunately we had a president who was able to make the movement. But they put them there to intimidate us and perhaps use them if necessary or to have an edge. And some of the people here are younger and don't remember, but some of them are older and do remember. During the war, Russia was our ally. We supplied them with tremendous quantities of material on lend-lease, which was never paid for. We were good guys and let them occupy half of Europe while we took care of the other half, but sharing it with three other powers, and the Russians promptly took over their half. I don't know how anyone can sit here and not fear Russia. They will do anything they can do if we sit back and let them, even to us in the United States.
I have, excuse me.
In response to that, I think people who are afraid are going to deny if they're afraid. I think part of the question is, does the buildup of armaments really relieve that fear? I think our fears are so deep. They have to do with life and death. They have to do with the unknown, the unknown what faces us. Just the basic human fears that people have had forever. I think where we're misplaced is to think that building up armaments is going to relieve those fears, when in truth, they won't, because we're all going to die. And as Christians, even death isn't the ultimate. And so, though I'm afraid of dying, I have to admit that, and I wouldn't like to die in a war, the part of me that can remain faithful has to say, building up armaments is not going to relieve my fear of death. Faith that nothing separates me from the love of Jesus Christ is the only thing that's going to relieve my fear.
Well, we sank a lot of battleships after World War II, and this helped perhaps Hitler to get strong the way he did. I would be very happy with disarmament. I think it's terrible to spend money. If we could depend on the people we're disarming with to really disarm with us. And I know right now we're not talking to them. I think we have to talk to them. I'm not opposed to that. But I think the fear is there, regardless. I would be happy if we could disarm bilaterally.
That's like saying I'd be happy to take the risk if I knew I wasn't going to be hurt in the risk. As I've been learning, I'd be happy to jump into the risk of marriage if I knew it was going to be connubial bliss. We don't. To risk means to not to know what's on the other side. To take that leap means that we aren't guaranteed that the response is going to be just as we would plan it. So if we wait to be assured that it's going to be very safe when we take risks, then we're not going to call them risk. I think the Christian life is a life of risk.
That's true, that some of us have fear that there's no risk involved. It's a certainty that with total disarmament or with unilateral disarmament, they just don't have to maybe throw any bombs to take over. But they will do so at their leisure and maybe peace mind as they choose to. And the thing that confuses me is, does the Christian play a role in what happens in the course of events.
Yes, but I think without bias.
Or you choose death at the other guy's hand.
That's right. Yes.
I don't.
But does that change the course of
events? It's not our responsibility to change the course of events if we believe God rules the world. Our power to respond to it.
Yeah, but God works through people. If we don't do anything, nothing will get done.
But does God ever work through violence?
No.
Directly.
No. I won't.
Directly,
no, I
maybe.
Yeah, I'm.
Well, God tends to be violent.
In Christ.
Yeah, in Christ.
Talking about Old Testament and what, how God works and stuff, and worrying about the behavior of Russia. If you look at the example of Syria, I don't think there's any country that was more ruthless in the ancient world than the Assyrians, and how God handled that when Assyria threatened Israel.
God also handled Assyria through Jonah and save Nineveh. I mean, there's a lot of grace in the Old Testament, too, from the people who are considered the most vile, the most unspeakably cruel people on earth. Were saved. They also came in for God's grace. They're also children of God.
I have a... go ahead. Question.
The thought that's been racing in my head is possibly wrong. I've never fought in a war, and I never tried to protect the country, or I had within that generation that I'm wondering if it isn't a betrayal of faith to say, I don't think God can protect me well enough. I've got to do something about it. Or to say, I don't think he can take care of us well enough. That we have to go out and start doing something about it. I don't know that means that we have to be Americans. I like Americans. I would like to be an American. But if that's not the course we take, it's not the course we take. I have to have the faith to say, lead on.
Seems to me that there is such a polarization that exists between persons who are saying we take a very radical stance biblically, holding to nonviolence and holding to the risks that are involved, and persons who are saying we can take what we want biblically. But the word that has gone around day after day, whenever the film is used, whenever any discussion comes up, is what is realism all the time, the reality of things, who decide that that there is a necessary salvation through politics, and the arm of politics that becomes defense or offense, whatever that would be. Is there any way that there can be dialogue in a real sense in the church, much less the political arena, on that issue that will bring about any change? Or do people have to make that decision and then hold to that and risk that? I remember a comment in one of Haig's first press conferences when he was talking about the appointment of persons who were going to be involved with the leadership in human rights under the new administration, and criticizing what the Carter administration had done, what Haig perceived as weakness in terms of holding back on economic aid and military aid to our allies throughout the world who were breaking or who were having violations of human rights. And that Haig said that that doesn't count. And he used the words that the Carter administration was too theological in dealing with human rights and dismissed that. And the people who were around him laughed and nodded and said, that's right. Is there any way that there can be any bridge or any dialogue of real meaning and real change? Or is Christ's word a sword that divides us?
Well, it seems to me that the question that's being addressed through what has been discussed the last couple of days is, how much of my life does my Christian faith control? You have to decide for yourself if it controls absolutely everything, and then decide what it is. Is it justice? Is it only my act of worship? Is it everything I do? And then you proceed from there after you've made that decision. Do you rely on your Christian faith in everything you do, or military formulas, or political games, or whatever? And when you've made that decision, then you will, you have to proceed with whatever decision it is. If it's total, every aspect of your life, that's the way you go.
I wonder if the division is as sharp as you have proposed that it might be. I'd like to know how many people here are in favor of building the MX missile system.
I'm not sure what these questions.
Well, it's my question, and that's, I just wanted to see. So there's nobody here that really is on the far extreme that perhaps is one end of a caricature. I don't, you know, in my own life, I don't know of anybody of the circle of friends that I've got who's out pounding a tub saying, build the MX, you know, 37 more Tridents, you know, $1 billion for this and $1 trillion for that. I don't know anybody like that. There must be some people somewhere that are like that. But I don't know who they are. But I know that there are a lot of people who are saying that we have something that's worth preserving. And there has to be something between where we were and where we might be. And that's, you know, that's the middle ground. I don't know that we're as far apart as perhaps you've said there.
There is one point, though. I graduated from Virginia Military Institute. I know a fair number of people who did go into the military.
Louder.
I know a fair number of people who did go into the military. And I can remember one instructor saying, if there ever is a war, our mission has failed. Now, people who really believe that. I do think, in reference to what you said, that if there was a military person with that deep concern, and I've met them, they would have a hard time participating in this discussion. I think it would be a very threatening thing for them to do. And I think that should be a concern for us, because if we can't dialogue with some of the people who are in the military, who are deeply concerned with this, without labeling them right off as immediately, before any discussion, as being obviously wrong, then there aren't going to be many people like that left in the military. They need some support community too. And there's a lot of others there that don't have that view. And that's scary. So the question of the dialogue as a community, we have to be very sensitive to that and try and dialogue with them. And they need to be part of that community too. And I think there may be some polarization there that would make it very hard for them to participate. Okay. So none of us are really in that position.
I think that whether or not dialogue is actually possible, it's the thing that we have to seek, because I don't see any other way that we can affect change if that is what we hope to do.
There's another item of concern that hasn't been injected at this point. And unfortunately, Mark Hatfield's the only one I've heard in the Washington scene articulating is a concern for the kind of condition in which communism really spreads, moves in, and takes over. And as he describes that situation, it seems to be the situation that Christians, in their compassion, ought most to be evident and on the scene, dealing with the hungry, the impoverished, the injustice situation around the world. And my anxiety and fear is not so much what the Russians might do or what our government might do and the destruction that may come out of that. My anxiety is that we as Christians will have to face the fact that we've probably not done near what we could have done and might have done to love and care for people, and to urge our government, one of those would be urge that conversation. I don't know how many times President Reagan has talked to Mr. Brezhnev, or if ever, or if he's read the book about life, or how many other leaders in Washington have done that, or been urged to by caring and concerned Christians. That's all I can say.
Along that line, one of the things that always amazes me, when, especially in any discussion about Soviet intentions through Central America or any kind of domino theory that exists within this hemisphere, is that after the revolution in Nicaragua, within a couple of years, there are thousands of young Cubans who have brought that nation from a state of illiteracy, who have developed the health care services and everything else. If the percentage of people in this country, whether it would be a nationalistic thing or whether it would be a Christian mission action to serve others, to be a servant people, would match the percentage of young Cubans who are all over the world providing medical services, literacy, and all other kinds of services as a statement about their faith and their system, it would be a far different society that we exist in here, and a far different world climate, I think.
Don't we have the Peace Corps?
Where's the Peace Corps gone from the initial idealism and the initial commitment in funding, in concern, moral leadership that has been? Yeah.
No, at Peace Corps, I don't know about Lutheran Church, but I was a Methodist missionary in the Philippines. And the world division of Methodist Church is shrinking. Just, you know, shriveling on the vine. And I don't know about Lutheran missions, but we're just not doing it at all. Peace Corps is doing the same thing. I mean, dribbling it. So I would agree very strongly with you. You know, we could argue whether the Cubans were overseas voluntarily or involuntarily or whatever, but this gets to the idea of an affluent society that's willingness to sacrifice for what's important. And I got a couple of things in my mind there. I know I've read some stuff on where you perceive an enemy and what we do with it. The Japanese figured that they would be able to take over Southeast Asia, and that America would be so far away, and America would get so tired of it that they would just essentially, after a couple of years, lose interest and the war would be over and the Japanese would have a disastrous situation. They miscalculated the rage that Pearl Harbor created. But essentially, the Vietnamese did the same thing, and it worked. And Brezhnev's most recent comment said, okay, right, you want to get into an arms race? We can sacrifice, and we'll do it, but your people will get disenchanted. You're going to have economic dislocations and riots in your cities, and your people will vote you out of office, and we'll do the same thing again, which very well may be true because of the willingness to sacrifice for the comfort that we have.
I think time for one more comment.
Well, to your question, Harvey, about what we might do in the church, I was with a group of students on Christian Marxist Dialogue to East Germany in 1972, and remember one amusing encounter with Christian friends in East Germany. The students had decided that the question they wanted to ask when we met this group was, how can you be a Christian and a socialist? And so they posed the question in all naivete, a charming kind of naivete. And the other folks laughed, and they said, you know what question we wanted to ask you? How can you be a Christian and a capitalist? And so we laughed then with each other and got into a wonderful conversation that kind of transcended the categories that we had for one another, and it genuinely changed points of view among those involved in the dialogue. And I've often thought that how often our discussion of topics such as these in the churches in the United States is unwittingly shaped by our assumptions of the national boundaries as somehow coterminous with our assumptions of our Christian responsibility. So the national interest functions as the norm, and we sort of, whether no matter what side we're on, we argue as if those boundaries were the boundaries of our Christian identity. And maybe the thing to do is to take the oikoumene seriously, that our initial citizenship is that of the whole world and God, and to seek out whether, as Dave said, whether it's Christians in the military in the United States or those of us who aren't, together to try to make contact with the points of view and the persons and other members of the body around the world. I mean, I'd like to know what Namibian Christians have to say about U.S. foreign policy and have that shape my views. I'd like to know what the El Salvadorian Christians have to say. I'd like to know if I can find out what the Christians in China or the Christians in the Soviet Union, how do they see these things? And then on the basis of a common faith, participate in a dialogue. It just may have the effect of our little exchange in East Germany and the United States of transcending the categories and putting it on a different level. It may overcome some fears too.
I would mention that again, 4 o'clock tomorrow at Shelley 1, there will be discussion on peacemaking, possible ways of doing that. And to thank all of you who came and all of you who participated in the forum, and you are welcome for those of you who want to stay at 10:15 for the compliment service.